following is a production of the Media Ministry at New Salem Baptist Church in Soddy Daisy, Tennessee, featuring the teaching of Pastor Alan Rogers. In the Metro Chattanooga area, we invite you to be our guest at any of our weekly worship services or visit us online at newsalembaptist.net. Now here's Pastor Alan.
When I was growing up, one of my earliest memories of watching television was a game show back in the 70s called To Tell the Truth. How many of you remember that one? Oh, quite a few hands. Okay. Not dating myself too bad then. The way it would work, for those of you who are not familiar with it, each episode would begin with a contestant saying, and just pick a name, I am Joe Smith. And then there'd be another contestant who would say, no, I'm Joe Smith. And then a third contestant who would say, I'm Joe Smith. And so for the next 30 minutes, a celebrity panel would question these three contestants to determine who is the real Joe Smith. And at the end of the show, when all the votes are in, the MC would say, would the real Joe Smith please stand up? And when the great reveal took place, it was always interesting to see when the celebrities got it right and when they guessed wrong. And sometimes the true contestant was the person you least expected. A major theme in the Gospel of Mark is true discipleship. What it means to really repent and believe the gospel, to become a follower of Jesus, to truly enter into God's kingdom. And Mark gives us, at the end of chapter 12, two vignettes contrasting two different sets of people. Now, either one of these vignettes can stand on its own. There's lessons we can learn from both of them. But when you set them side by side, it becomes really interesting to see the contrast here. It forces us to ask the question, which of these are the true disciples? In essence, Mark is saying, will the true disciple please stand up? And it turns out to be not whom a lot of people would expect. And so as we read this passage together, we are forced to answer that same question. When we look at these two sets of people, who are the true disciples? And where do we see ours? Which of these groups more closely characterizes us? Are we true disciples? Let's read this passage quickly, and we'll the first couple of verses anyway, because one of the things we'll see here in this first group is something about false disciples. And we will see that false disciples are superficial. Starting in verse 38, in his teaching, he was saying, beware of the scribes who like to walk around in long robes and like respectful greetings in the marketplace and chief seats in the synagogues and places of honor at banquets, who devour widows' houses and for appearance sake offer long prayers. These will receive greater condemnation. Now, one of the reasons false disciples are superficial is because false disciples rob God of His glory. If you'd asked a lot of people in Jesus' day, who has really got it together? Who are the truly righteous people? Who are the godly ones? Then most people would have pointed to this group known as the scribes. As we've talked about before, the scribes were a group of highly trained Bible scholars who acted like lawyers in interpreting the teachings of the law of Moses, which was at the core of Jewish culture. And because of their role in teaching everybody else what it meant to obey God, these scribes played an important role in Jewish society. Yet, here's Jesus saying, beware the scribes. Throughout this gospel, in fact, Mark has shown that Jesus and the scribes were often at odds. All the way back in Mark chapter 3, verses 22 through 30, the scribes accused Jesus of actually being an emissary of Satan, which leads Jesus to respond and accuse them of blaspheming God's Spirit, saying, you guys are taking what God's doing and you're trying to say it's satanic? In Mark 7, the scribes and their partners, the sect known as the Pharisees, accused Jesus of violating the traditions of Judaism, leading Jesus to accuse them of using those same man-made traditions to, as cover to skirt around God's clear commandments. In Mark 11, verse 18, we read how some of the influential scribes were conspiring with the leadership of the temple to find a way to get rid of Jesus, to destroy him. He was upsetting the status quo. He was challenging their influence and their power in society, so he had to go. In Mark 11, 27, just a few verses later, the scribes and their allies challenged Jesus' authority to preach and teach. What gives you the right to do this, Jesus? Then in Mark 12, verse 12, the only reason the scribes and their allies do not move publicly to have Jesus arrested is because they were afraid of Jesus' popularity with the common people. In fact, the only positive interaction Mark shows between Jesus and a scribe occurs in Mark 28, verse 34, Mark 12, verses 28 through 34, a passage we looked at a couple of weeks ago. If you'll remember, a scribe asked Jesus his opinion on a common Jewish debate. What's the greatest commandment of God's law? If you had to boil the entire law down to one statement, what would it be? And Jesus gave him an answer in two parts. You remember what those were? Love God with everything you got. He says in Mark 12, 30, and love your neighbor as yourself. Mark 12, 31. It was on the basis of those greatest commandments that Jesus warned his followers to beware the scribes. Because instead of loving God for his own sake, many of the scribes were actually guilty of using God to further their own agendas. Now, because of their skill and their supposed godliness, these scribes held a position of privilege in their society. As Jesus alludes to, the scribes wore special clothing to identify their office. This included a long white linen shawl that would stand out in a crowd. If you saw some scribes walking through the marketplace, you knew immediately who they were because of that shawl. These long robes also marked out a man who was known more for working with his head than with his hands. Because if you're doing manual labor, that robe's going to get in the way. So these guys were special. They didn't have to get their hands dirty. The scribes' privilege was also demonstrated in how other people were required to treat them. As Jesus said, the scribes received respectful greetings in the marketplace. Jewish tradition required ordinary people to recognize and greet scribes in public. The only people exempt from that were craftsmen who were actually engaged in erecting a structure, because that might prove a safety problem if they had to stop and greet a scribe while they're doing that. But everybody else, they bump into a scribe out in the street, "Oh, favored rabbi, how are you?" You know, they had to defer to them. And the scribe's privilege was also demonstrated in the seating that was reserved for them in the synagogue and at social occasions. In the synagogue meetings, the scribes typically were seated in front of the special cabinet where the Torah scrolls were kept. In front, facing the rest of the congregation. So everybody in the congregation could see these guys. They were right at the center of attention. At social occasions, scribes were often set at the place of honor at the head table next to the host. Even if the host's parents were there, usually the scribes were seated in a better place than even the host's own parents. And both of these arrangements in the synagogue and at social occasions gave the scribes maximum visibility. And it communicated, these men are important. These men have influence. You need to defer to these men. And according to Jesus, these scribes not only received the special attention, some of them rather enjoyed it. Now, according to Jesus, they craved this status and they cultivated it. Instead of seeking to glorify God, they were stealing his glory in order to increase their own. Look at us. We're scribes. Instead of loving God and giving everything to God, they were using God to get things for themselves. Now, sadly, this kind of glory stealing is not limited to first century Jewish scribes. Now, let me just say this. I love pastors. I is one. Okay? I talk to pastors, many pastors throughout the course of a normal week. It's a pretty close fellowship. A lot of us, I got a couple of groups I get together at least once a month, and we commiserate together. And you know, we talk about you. We don't mention any names. No. It's amazing how many of you are in the same churches. The faces are different, the names are different, but the same people. But I know some good, godly men who love the Lord and love their churches and are trying to serve faithfully and demonstrate godly character. But there are others. In every crowd, there's some bad apples, right? And I know others. Over the years, I've known many pastors who are overly concerned about their image. Okay, and that includes some of the more traditional guys who go everywhere looking like they just stepped out of a Brooks Brothers catalog. Okay, there, when I was in seminary, we had a story. This man had passed away by the time I got to New Orleans, but there was a story about a seminary professor, godly man, but he used to literally mow his grass wearing a coat, a tie, and a fedora. In New Orleans. So I wonder if he didn't have a heat stroke. But I know guys that are like, you know, that everywhere they go, they're dressed to the nines. But this also includes some of the younger guys, more contemporary pastors, who insist on dressing in the latest hipster fashions. Don't ever look for me to wear skinny jeans, okay? Not going to happen. Would not be a pretty sight. There's not enough grease in Soddy Daisy to make that happen. You know, I believe, you know, pastors ought to dress nicely. We ought to, my rule of thumb I was always taught is, you know, try to be one step above the people in the pews, just to show some dignity. I have no problem wearing a suit. I'm kind of glad things have gotten a lot more casual because I enjoy that. You know, it's a lot more comfortable. But you don't get wrapped up on the outside, folks. What one wears on the outside is not as important as what one is on the inside. Over the years, I've known guys who were overly concerned about their titles and degrees. Now, I get it. You worked hard enough to get that degree. You want other people to respect that. I understand, okay? I've been there, done that. One of the reasons, I mentioned this last week, and I don't want to go on the whole story, but one of the reasons I made the tough decision, when I made that decision to withdraw from my PhD program, one of the things I had to wrestle with was how much of my pride was wrapped up in that degree. After all, I had invested 5 hard years in that program. You know, made good grades. In fact, in that program, if you made less than a B, you didn't get credit for the class, so you had to make good grades. Done all the coursework. You know, I was close to finishing, but for me, it basically came down to a matter of time, money, and priorities. I decided my kids needed DAD better than I needed some fancy letters after my name. And at the end, I concluded, if I was not enough without the degree, I would never be enough with it. Sadly, there are a lot of guys who've never figured that out. Got nothing against education, but it's not about being somebody. Every now and then, someone will ask me, well, what do you prefer to be called? My stock answer is just don't call me late for dinner. Okay, now, you know, you can call me Alan. That's my name. You can call me brother. That emphasizes the relationship we share as brothers and sisters in Christ. You can call me pastor. That reflects my function in the church. Those are fine. Those are perfectly acceptable. A while back, somebody questioned me about a document we had circulated. It was an older document, and it listed me, identified me as Reverend Rogers. And this dear saint was, Pastor, are you trying to go highfalutin on us? And I'm like, no, that simply means I have been ordained by a church and I can legally marry and bury you. Okay, that's all it means. I've had that title since 1988, I think it was, but don't usually flash it around because to me, it, like I said, it's not a big deal. Call me pastor. That's a lot more personal. I like that. I've known guys who think the title pastor allows them to boss people around with no accountability. Okay, unfortunately, I've run into guys like that before. The truth is, the pastor is not the boss of the church, nor should he be. Jesus is the boss of the church. He is the head. The pastor is called to shepherd the church, guide the church, to feed the church, to protect the church, not use the church to enrich himself. Now, sometimes in order to lead, the pastor does have to assert his authority, but that should always be done with gentleness and with the health of the church in mind. Okay, I try very hard not to pull that pastor card. I know some guys that pull it with regularity. They use it as a shield to avoid being held accountable. Folks, we're all accountable. Pastors are accountable. He's accountable to God for how well he leads the congregation. In our polity, he's also accountable to you, to the people in the pews. Because y'all voted to bring me in, y'all could vote to send me out. The same is also true not only of pastors, but of other church leaders. If you're a deacon, if you're a Sunday school teacher, if you're a committee head, if you're a team leader, if you serve in any role of leadership, you are accountable. We're all accountable to God together. The only difference between you and me is my function in this church. Okay, I struggle with the same things you struggle with. I hurt the same things you hurt with. I struggle at times with pride. I struggle at times with hurt feelings. I struggle with temptation just like you do. I'm not immune from that. Sometimes it's even worse because the enemy would love to take a pastor out. I struggle with doubts. It's not like I have a direct pipeline to God necessarily just because I'm a pastor. I struggle with relationships. That's normal. We're all different people. As we're trying to do life together, as we're trying to work together, as we're trying to lead together, sometimes we're going to bump up against each other. The key is, how do we handle that, okay? You know, that where we do we work it out? Jesus gives us a process in Matthew 18 for how we do that. Starting with just getting together one-on-one and trying to find some common ground. I'm a big believer. I came of age back when Stephen Covey was kind of the big guru, you know, the seven habits of highly effective leaders. And a couple of those have always stuck with me. Seek first to understand, then to be understood. Okay? In other words, open your ears up. The other one is look for the win-win. That's the way I try to operate. Let's find consensus. Let's find a way where we both get a little something what we want here. Okay? Some guys aren't like that. It's got to be their way or the highway. I struggle with my kids. Anybody struggle with their kids? You know, I love my kids to death. Sometimes I have to fight with my kids about coming to church. But they say, but Dad, you're the pastor. You have to go to church. I'm glad some of y'all got that. Had me worried there for a minute. The point is, we all share the same struggles. We all have to lean on the same grace to make it through. None of us have arrived, and God is ready and able to take any of us down a peg if he needs to. False disciples not only rob God of his glory, they also rob their neighbors of their goods. In Jewish culture, first century Jewish culture, the scribes were actually prohibited from charging for their religious services. So how did these guys make a living? Well, some of them did it with side jobs, like Paul. You know, Paul was a tent maker by trade. Others did it with donations. Okay? And we're not exactly sure what Jesus means here when he talks about they devour widows' houses in verse 40. But the implication seems to be that some of the scribes were taking advantage of the generosity of vulnerable people in order to enrich themselves. Whether they were doing that by sweet-talking these little ladies and giving them all their money, whether they were arranging to, you know, whether they were operating as slumlords, you know, they control people's housing. Whether they got, in some cases, maybe actually had people sign their deeds over to their houses, so they actually control the houses. We're not exactly sure. We see little examples of this all through the commentary down through history, but we're not exactly sure. But one thing we do know is they were taking advantage of people for themselves, to enrich themselves. And in doing so, they were violating that other great commandment to love their neighbors as themselves. So true disciples do not violate those commandments. These supposedly pious men were not loving God with everything they had. They were actually stealing God's glory. Well, they should have been mirrors of that glory. And they were bringing harm to their neighbors. True disciples do not set out to harm their neighbors. And here's the thing. These guys should have known better. They should have known better. Those who cover their unrighteousness in a religious veneer will face greater accountability for God. Many of these scribes try to cover up their corruption with public displays of piety, like making long public prayers. A buddy of mine I went to seminary with, he grew up in Hickson like I did, and we went to UTC together. We actually helped us and our wives actually helped each other move to New Orleans. We shared the same truck to move our stuff down to New Orleans. And you got to understand Randy's background. He, you know, his family came from a rural kind of background. He was one of the first people in his family to not only go to college, but to actually go to graduate school, to seminary, working on his master's degree. And he told this story. I can't remember if it was like the first time all of us came home for, you know, on break for Thanksgiving or what. It was like a semester after we started. And he said, you know, of course, one of the things you get used to if you're the minister is at family gatherings, guess who gets asked to say grace? It's kind of a given. So I think it was Thanksgiving, they asked him to say the prayer. And he just said a little simple prayer. And his dad said, all that schooling, that's the best you can do. Oh, but there's some guys, man, they describe, you know, they got to be a center of attention. I don't watch award shows. I stopped watching the award shows a long time ago. But one of the last award shows we watched, it was a country music awards, one of those. And there was a young lady who was kind of the up-and-coming star that year. And at the end, they had this big finale where everybody came out to sing this song together. And I never forget. You know, she was like the big, hot young artist that year. And she's out there. She's jamming around her guitar. She's singing. And I told my wife this. I said, yeah, watch this. It seemed like every time the camera shot changed, she found a way to be right in the center of that shot. This happened like 4 or 5 times. I'm like, she is looking for that camera, and she's throwing an elbow like an NBA player to get in front of that camera. Now, she's one of the biggest stars in the world right now, but, you know, there are some pastors like that. There's some other church leader. It doesn't have to be a pastor. It can be a lay leader. It can be a deacon. It can be a Sunday school teacher, a committee chairman, who they're always seeking the limelight. They're always trying to be the center. They're always seeking to bring the power to themselves. That's not how this works, folks. We are called as people of God to do things differently. And you can cover it up with all the religious covering you want to call it, but if you're leading God's people in an ungodly way, you're not doing it for God's glory. And Jesus says, these will receive a greater condemnation because they should have known better. They knew Deuteronomy 6:5. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your mind, all your soul, all your strength. They knew Leviticus 19:18. Love your neighbor as yourself. And yet, they were doing this anyway. Wouldn't want to be them on Judgment Day. And I pray regularly, God, check my heart. Check my heart. Don't let me be that kind of person. And if you're leading in any capacity, I hope that prayer is yours as well. Here's the thing about true disciples, okay? False disciples are superficial, but true disciples are sacrificial. In verse 41, he sat down opposite the treasury and began observing how the people were putting money into the treasury. And many rich people were putting in large sums. A poor widow came and put in 2 small copper coins, which amounted to a cent. Calling his disciples to him, he said to them, truly, I say to you, this poor widow put in more than all the contributors to the treasury. For they all put in out of their surplus, but she, out of her poverty, put in all she owned, all she had to live on. Well, here what we see is, first of all, true disciples go all in for God. All in. Jesus and his disciples apparently were sitting in an area of the temple known as the Court of the Women. A few weeks ago we talked about there's these concentric courtyards surrounding the temple. This is in the Court of Women. This is where all the Jewish people were allowed to come and pray. And along one wall of that courtyard were a series of metal receptacles known as the trumpets. There were 13 of them. And they had this, you know, like big, wide, kind of, if you've ever seen an old Victrola, you know, they had this big, wide cup and it narrows down into a narrow neck and goes down into the receptacle where the money falls. And these receptacles were designated to receive the various offerings that people would bring at the temple. You know, there's probably maybe like we do, we have a general budget and we got designated funds that go to special projects, you know, and stuff. And so people could pick and choose where they put their money. And they were designed with these long, narrow necks that tended to amplify the sound as the coins were dropped in that funnel. So imagine the sound as a wealthy patron comes by and drops a whole bag of silver and gold coins down the mouth of that receptacle. And it probably reverberated throughout that whole courtyard. And another person steps up, and it's like they're trying to outdo each other by who can put the most in there, who can make the biggest noise. And all of a sudden, here comes this little lady, comes up. Clink, clink. 2 little coins. Mark calls them leptons in Greek. Those were the smallest local coins in circulation. For the benefit of his non-Jewish readers, he gives the Roman equivalent, which is a quadrans. That's where it says a cent. there in the way the New American Standard translates it. That was equivalent to about 1/60th of a typical day's wage. Think about how small, you know, take what you make in a day, 1/60th of that. Not very much at all. And with all the important people milling around the temple, putting these huge sums of money in those funnels, it was this little old lady, this poor widow, that caught Jesus' attention. Now, as a widow, she would have been on the lower end of the social scale. Instead of fancy shawls, her clothing was simple and plain. No one would make a point to greet her in the marketplace. She probably had to sit on the back row at social occasions, assuming she was even invited. Yet she drew Jesus' attention because she gave her all to God. The others had given what they had left over, but she gave everything. What was the commandment? Love the Lord your God with all. Now, it'd be a reasonable assumption that many of the other worshipers gave at most 10% of their income as designated by as a tithe under the law of Moses. Of course, if it's like church today, it's probably closer to 2% if they gave it all. Some may have given a little more, but only because they had an abundance, because they wouldn't miss it. Think about this. A tithe on an income of $100,000 comes out to about $10,000. Now, that's a lot of money. Any way you cut it, that's a lot of money, right? However, it still leaves at least $90,000 to live on. How many of you could live quite comfortably on $90,000? A lot of us. Yeah. On the other hand, a tithe on an income of $30,000 comes out to about $3,000. That's still a lot of money. That leaves $27,000 to live on, which would be quite a challenge for most people. You know, $3,000, that's a couple of house payments. That's 2-3 months rent for some people. And living on $27,000 a year? You better be paying attention to Dave Ramsey on that. That's not a lot of money. But here's the thing. God doesn't look at the size of the gift, but the size of the sacrifice. And since she only had two coins, man, nobody would have blamed this woman for keeping at least one of those coins to herself. I mean, that would have been an offering of 50%, well over the tithe. But she didn't give 10%. She didn't give 50%. According to Jesus, she gave 100%. She gave it all. This woman literally lived out the greatest commandment by giving God everything. And since her sacrifice would in part go to help others, she was also fulfilling the commandment to love others as herself. She was putting her money where her faith was. And that leads me to the final point. True disciples walk by faith. Jesus pointed out this woman gave everything she had to live on. In other words, she was living in faith that God would somehow supply her needs. How many of us would have that kind of faith? How many of us would have the faith to go drain your bank account and put it all in the offering plate? I'll be honest, I don't. And that would be tough. I don't think God necessarily expects us to drain our bank accounts and put it all in the offering plate. But He does expect us to be open to Him, to put it all on the altar at His disposal. And how we use it, not just our bank accounts, our calendars, our talents, everything about us should belong to Him. We've heard the story about Cortez's invasion of Mexico in 1519. That's the one where he ordered his men, when they reached the beach, burn all the ships. You know, no way to return to Spain. You're either going to have to conquer or die, gentlemen. Cortez and his men put all their chips in the pot to fulfill their mission. This poor godly woman went all in. She put all of her chips in on the pursuit of God's kingdom. Between the scribes and the widow, which one do you think more accurately describes true discipleship? Here's the kicker. Which one of these two more accurately describes you today? Is your devotion to God merely on the outside? Are you using God to try to impress other people, try to advance your own agenda, draw attention to yourself? Are you making a show about following God while secretly hedging your bets? Or are you really going all in? and trusting Him to supply what you truly need? Are you giving Him everything in your life? Is it all on the altar? Your relationships. God, I'm going to seek in my relationships, I'm going to seek to follow what you tell me to follow. I'm going to seek, as hard as it is, to forgive those who wrong me, to seek to work it out when a brother and I have a difficulty. I'm going to seek to keep my mouth shut when I'm upset with somebody, not to go and assassinate their character just because it makes me feel better. I'm going to seek, in my marriage, I'm going to seek to honor you by how I treat my spouse. I'm going to seek to honor you how I order my sexual identity in relationships. I'm going to trust you in that, God. What about your career? God, I'm going to give you my career. I'm going to run my business in a way that honors you. I'm not going to seek to fight, scratch, and claw my way to the top. I'm not going to seek to play these games where I undermine the people around me just so I get a leg up on them. I'm not going to cut corners. I'm not going to cheat. I'm going to do it the right way. I'm going to take the high road. I'm going to be a person of integrity so it honors you, Lord. How many of us can say that? How many of us give God our finances? God, I'm going to honor you in my finances. I'm going to honor you in the way I scale my lifestyle. I don't need the biggest house. I don't need the newest car. But I'm going to live within my means so I can give more into your kingdom so more people can hear about Jesus. And so that I can show that you have more of my heart. What about your leisure time? The way you choose to use that? What about how you invest your time and your talents? I know it's really hard right now because we're in a period of time where it's really hard to volunteer for stuff. You know, there's people watching today. You're not ready to come back into a crowd yet. I get it. I understand. But we can't live in pause forever. We can't live in neutral forever, church. Now, we may have to be creative about how we move forward. Where we're going may look a lot different than where we've been. We're going off the map like Lewis and Clark, but we got to move forward. How about the way you treat those with whom you disagree? Are you giving that to God as well? The path to God's kingdom requires us to go all in and walk by faith like this widow did. Are you all in today? Are you holding back part of it? And say, God, I'll just give you what I can afford to give. The rest of it's mine. Who was the true disciple?
This program is a production of the Media Ministry at New Salem Baptist Church. Music courtesy of Jason Shaw at audionautix.com. If you enjoy this program, we would love to hear from you. Email us at info@newsalembaptist.net. Thank you for listening.